It's Thursday, April 18, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Americans and others around the world remain riveted by the headlines coming out of Boston. The Boston bombing that took place during the Boston Marathon on Monday continues to shape the national and international news, as many people are asking the obvious question, and almost everyone is at least wondering who did this and why. We've talked about the fact that human beings immediately try to find some rational response to an outbreak of evil and murder such as this. But one of the things we need to recognize is that there is a righteous demand for justice. There is something that God the Creator has put within us that cries out for justice to be done against some awful and atrocious crime such as this. And thus, so many in the media right now are swarming around the question, what did the police know? What are law enforcement officials doing? How quickly can they solve this case? Who did it? And how can that individual or individuals be brought to a court of justice? We need to recognize at the onset that that is a righteous impulse, the same kind of impulse that leads prosecutors in Europe to go after those now in their 80s and 90s accused of war crimes and atrocities against humanity during World War II. It's the same kind of impulse that leads us to want to know, how will the perpetrator of such an awful act be brought to justice? But even as we recognize that that is a righteous impulse, we also need to recognize that in our new situation of digital media and instant news, there can be more confusion than reality about much of what is covered in the media. For instance, yesterday, for a good portion of the day, major news outlets were reporting that an arrest had been made in terms of the Boston bombings. It turned out that that was not the case. But as was clarified later by law enforcement officials, there was a major break in the case on Monday, and that was the discovery of video evidence of an individual acting suspiciously and planting a suspicious package, now suspected to be one of the bombs, along the route there of the terminus of the Boston Marathon. Now, this leads to another very interesting realization of how law enforcement officials do their job in the digital age. Look back to the arrest of the Unabomber some years ago. That case was solved when law enforcement officials decided to act in a way that was counterintuitive. For virtually all of modern law enforcement, the attempt has been by the investigators and the police to keep the information as close to the vest as possible, in order that perpetrators would not be aware of the fact that the progress against them in terms of investigation has continued. But in the Unabomber case, after months and years of indecisive and inconclusive investigation, the law enforcement officials decided to do the opposite, to put out as much information as possible in the hopes that that might trigger amongst someone in the general population a recognition of who was the perpetrator of these awful crimes. In that case, you may remember that once law enforcement officials put all that information out there, it was indeed the brother of the man discovered to be the Unabomber, who discovered in the language of documents written by this criminal a pattern that he recognized in his own brother. And that brother then did the right thing. He eventually led investigators to the Unabomber and thus to the successful investigation and prosecution of those crimes, and perhaps more importantly and urgently to the removal of a very real and present threat to human life. Now, what we're looking at right now is a dilemma that is being faced by law enforcement officials with the case in Boston. Will they reveal a good deal, not much, or virtually everything? Now we reach the point that in the digital age, the investigation may actually be in the hands of the people who are standing there as spectators, who with their camcorders, and actually more often now with their smartphones, were taking images and video of what was taking place. Now, in the vast cloud of information that is created virtually every minute in social media, the key to solving this case may well turn out to be on the smartphone or smartphones of individuals who were standing there when the explosions took place. What we're looking at here is a revolution in terms of law enforcement and investigation. However, it's not a revolution in terms of human morality. It just leads to a very different telling of the story of the morality tale of humanity and of how the human quest for justice is carried out. Meanwhile, the scene shifts to Washington, D.C., where investigators have discovered evidence of the vastly dangerous poison ricin in mail that was sent to one United States senator and also to the White House addressed to President Barack Obama. In the Senate case, it was a letter addressed to Senator Roger Wicker, a Republican of Mississippi. In the case of the White House, of course, the target was the President of the United States. These are described as amateurish attempts. But on the other hand, the question, of course, that comes to most of us is whether this is a coincidence. You'll recall that along with the Al-Qaeda attacks on New York and Washington back in 2001 came anthrax attacks by mail, attacks that have still to this point been largely inconclusively settled. Now this comes, and because the letters were mailed before the events in Boston took place, the automatic question is this merely a coincidence? Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, who of course was famously formerly a very successful prosecutor as a United States attorney, gave a very interesting point of law enforcement logic when he said to the media yesterday, take note of this, when something appears to be a coincidence, it almost never is. Then he said after a pause, sometimes coincidences happen. In other words, the investigators must assume that there might be a link, but eventually they're going to have to prove that such a link does or does not exist. The larger question here, of course, is the question of morality and the moral nature of humanity, and this is where the Christian worldview comes in with a distinctive contribution that almost always is a corrective to that which is held by the larger culture. Evidence of that comes in an article that was published at CNN by Will Cain when he asked the question, is man inherently good or evil? Now, you can almost count on the fact that when someone asks that question, they're going to answer it by saying that man is inherently good. Speaking here of humanity, Will Cain writes, 3 dead bodies, 20 to 30 missing limbs, and more than 180 injured can force us to revisit that age-old question. What is the state of man's nature? Is he inherently good or evil? The Boston Marathon bombings have presented us with the dilemma of Locke, there he means John Locke, versus Hobbes, he means Thomas Hobbes, again. In other words, he's pointing here to John Locke, who had an overwhelmingly optimistic view of human nature, and then to Thomas Hobbes, who, in his work Leviathan and so many others, pointed to what he had as a basically inherently pessimistic understanding of human nature. In other words, Hobbes expected people to do that which is wrong most of the time. Locke expected people to do that which is right most of the time. They both attributed this to their understanding of human nature. Will Cain then writes, events such as these, or rather men responsible for events such as these, don't define us. Well, let's wait for a moment. Maybe they do. In other words, if we're going to tell the story of humanity honestly, we're going to have to start with the fact that human beings are sinners. From the Christian point of view, and especially from the Christian biblical worldview, we're going to have to make very clear that when we see eruptions of evil like this, we're not seeing something that is contrary to human nature. We're looking at something that comes altogether too natural to human nature. As we've discussed on this program, the reason why these incidents do not erupt more often and the reason why more people do not give themselves to such crimes is attributable to the fact that God offers us a restraining grace, that His providence operates as a restraining grace, that the law that He has given us restrains us, and that the conscience He has implanted within us restrains us as well. You take away those evidences of God's restraining grace, and we are in the state of fallen nature that Hobbes saw with all of his pessimism. Only it will be infinitely worse than Hobbes had ever predicted. The reality is, however, that when someone like Will Cain asked in this article, are men, he means humanity, is humanity inherently good or evil? It's not a question you can answer yes or no, good or evil. What we have to do is look at it in biblical terms. But what the secularly minded want to do is to come up with an easy answer. The answer yes or no, the question good or evil. This is how Will Cain answers it. He says, events such as these don't define us. Goes on to say, quoting Patton Oswalt, the actor who put up a Facebook post, quote, if it's one person or 100 people, that number is not even a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent of the population on this planet, end quote. Well, that's actually mathematically true, but it turns out to be theologically irrelevant. In other words, the question is, what do these events say, not just about those who perpetrate them, but about all of us? The actor Patton Oswalt went on to say, quote, the vast majority stands against that darkness, and like white blood cells attacking a virus, they dilute and weaken and eventually wash away the evildoers, and more importantly, the damage they wreak. This is beyond religion or creed or nation. We would not be here if humanity were inherently evil. We'd have eaten ourselves alive long ago, end quote. Well, what we see here is an evidence of secular reasoning, the kind of secular reasoning we would expect of someone who's operating out of a worldview very different than that of the Bible. In other words, he's making claims here that, when we reflect upon them, simply don't add up. He says, for instance, that like white blood cells attacking a virus, good acts weaken and eventually wash away evildoers and the damage they wreak. That isn't true. No human goodness, no acts of human kindness, graciousness, righteousness, or nobility can return life to those whose lives were snuffed out by this bomber, can restore limbs to those who were blown apart by this bomber, can completely heal a civilizational fabric that was sundered and torn by this bomber. He writes, quote, "So when you spot violence or bigotry or intolerance or fear or just garden variety misogyny, hatred or ignorance, just look it in the eye and think, the good outnumber you, and we always will." End quote. Now, I mean no disrespect to this actor, nor to Will Cain in writing this article, but that is manifest nonsense. It's nonsense because what we do in any effort like this is to define evil so that what we do every day doesn't count. Recall the difference between that worldview and that which is revealed by the Holy Spirit through the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1. By the time you come to the end of Romans chapter 1, there's an entire catalog of human evil. It's described as an evil that by its very nature is evidence of the human quest to suppress the truth in unrighteousness, those who exchange the worship of the Creator for the worship of the creature. Now, it starts out with sins that are publicly notorious, and, awkward though it is to say in terms of our contemporary moment, it begins with homosexuality, both male and female. But then, lest we feel good about ourselves, it gets down to where we live, and frankly, where we live every day. Amongst the evildoers who are identified as doing evil are those who are disobedient to parents. Met anyone like that lately? And those who are gossips and backbiters. In other words, it turns out that the list of human sin, described by our Creator as inherently evil, doesn't start and end with bombing and genocide. For that matter, it doesn't start and end with sex and adultery or homosexuality or any other form of sexual sin. All those things are included, but it comes right down to those who are disobedient to parents, which means every living human being. And it gets down to those who gossip and slander and backbite. In other words, we want to define sin in such a way that evil is something other than what we do. It's easy to look at a situation like this, drawn immediately from the headlines, and say, thank goodness there are more good people than bad people. There are more people who run the marathon than try to kill the people running it. But on the other hand, from a Christian worldview, we have to understand that every single human being running that race was also a sinner who does evil deeds. We should be very thankful that the people who live around us are not unrestrained in terms of their evil, such that we do exactly what this actor Patton Oswalt warned. We would be so evil as to have eaten ourselves alive long ago. Thanks be to God that didn't happen. But think about the way we just had to say that. Thanks be to God that didn't happen. In other news, New Zealand has become the 13th nation to legalize same-sex marriage. Even in the beginning of this week, it looked like France would become the 13th nation, but it has to get in line now against New Zealand. New Zealand's parliament voted by a two-thirds margin to legalize same-sex marriage. New Zealand, along with much of Southeast Asia, is relatively liberal on these issues in terms of sexual behaviors, but most of that region is relatively conservative when it comes to preserving the institution of marriage and its definition. That may be changing, as it appears that political majorities in Australia are now pressing for the very same thing. Efforts to legalize same-sex marriage in Australia failed last year. But then again, just a little over a year ago, the President of the United States was against same-sex marriage. That was before his evolution. The Australians may be evolving as well. In the meantime, there is also news that Uruguay became the 12th nation to legalize same-sex marriage. What we're looking at here, viewed from the vantage point of the globe, is the reality that this is no longer an issue localized to Northern and to Western Europe, but now also to North America and to South America and now to Southeast Asia as well. But you'll note that other than the nation of South Africa, where the morality has more to do with Europe than with the African continent, in the rest of Africa, there is resolutely, at least at this point, no progress of those who are seeking to legalize same-sex marriage. The question may well be, for how long? But the thing to note about Africa is that there is a shared worldview, shaped by both Christianity and Islam and by more tribal and ethnic distinctions as well, where same-sex marriage is in many of those cultures virtually an impossibility. It is an irrational notion. But lest we think that that is in itself a bulwark against this kind of moral revolution, consider the fact that just 20 or 30 years ago, there was no legal category of same-sex marriage in Western nations as well. Another major story to watch takes place here in the United States. You'll recall that the prophet Amos wrote in Amos 3:3, "Can two walk together unless they be agreed?" That issue certainly comes to mind in the headline in the Wall Street Journal this week, "Church Fight Heads to Court." It has to do with the story by Valerie Bauerlein, published in the Wall Street Journal. It begins this way: Episcopalians along the South Carolina coast are battling in court to determine which of two factions owns an estimated $500 million in church buildings, grounds, and cemeteries following an acrimonious split last year over social issues. She goes on to write, the leadership and about two-thirds of the members of the Diocese of South Carolina, based in Charleston, broke away from the National Episcopal Church last November over its blessing of same-sex unions, ordination of gay clergy, and its liberal approach to other social and theological issues. The breakaway faction then filed a state lawsuit to assert ownership of 35 parishes, including many of the church's wealthiest in the state. The group says it shouldn't have to turn over property to a church that it believes has drifted from biblical principles. The Right Reverend Mark Lawrence, who is the bishop of the breakaway group, said, quote, the essential issue here is freedom of religion. We have the freedom to remove ourselves. In response comes Matthew D. McGill, a Washington, D.C. lawyer representing the Episcopal Church, who says this, quote, we strongly agree with the freedom of religion and the freedom of these folks to go their own way. You simply can't take it with you, end quote. Now, to many people in the Free Church tradition, this seems to be a very odd argument, an argument over property that is now in dispute because the diocese is broken away, but the National Church claims the ownership over the property. You may well recall that in Northern Virginia, several of the most historic and Orthodox Episcopal churches, congregations that later broke away and joined the Anglican Church, lost their property, including the historic property of the Falls Church there, the church that had once been the Church of George Washington, the church that gave the city of Falls Church, Virginia, its name, and now is a building owned by a church where the people have all left, virtually, and gone with the faithful congregation into Anglicanism. I've had the honor of speaking in the Anglican churches, formerly the Episcopal churches of South Carolina, and including in some of the churches in Charleston now most under dispute in terms of this court case. And I'll tell you this. We have to recognize that the way the Wall Street Journal reports the story makes sense journalistically, but it doesn't make sense biblically. Valerie Bauerlein ends her article with these words. How the fight will be resolved is difficult to tell. The National Church has prevailed in 12 similar disputes in state supreme or appellate court since 1980. Some religious scholars say such schisms are hurting the church's image and distracting attention that could be devoted to reversing a decline in church membership. Quote, once we're through the issue of property and gay people, the real issue is how can this church change its way of being? That was said by Frank Kirkpatrick, the author of a book entitled The Episcopal Church in Crisis, How Sex, the Bible, and Authority Are Dividing the Faithful, end quote. Here's what's wrong with the journalistic analysis of the situation. It assumes that here you have two churches arguing over a common faith and common property. The question is, how will these things be divided? The most interesting statement in this entire article is by Frank Kirkpatrick when he says, once we're through the issue of property and gay people. Just imagine what's being asserted there. These are issues we'll get through, and on the other side, we'll figure all these things out. What these issues demonstrate is that what we have here is a church and a false church. The Episcopalians who left and formed Anglican congregations there in South Carolina did not do so because they had a mere doctrinal dispute with their Anglican compatriots. No, they came to the understanding that they had to withdraw in order to remain the church, to hold to the faith once for all delivered to the saints, and to be able to have the freedom to teach all that the Bible teaches on issues as central as sexual morality. The Wall Street Journal, operating out of its own journalistic worldview, looks at this as an interesting court case. But those of us who look at this through the lenses of Scripture must see it as the validation of what Amos warned about very long ago. Can two walk together unless they be agreed? The answer to that, of course, is a profound no. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.